From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Washington Watch. I hope you had a great weekend. This is Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Monday afternoon. Don't blink this week because things are moving extremely fast in the nation's capital and you won't want to miss anything. So in our first segment today, the delay of the Senate impeachment vote until this Wednesday has set up a rather jam-packed and unprecedented week in the nation's capital with the president's State of the Union address, Iowa caucuses, the National Prayer Breakfast, the next round of Democratic debates, all taking place before the week's over. I have our own Travis Weber, Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, to help me break it all down in our first segment. In my second segment, the Iowa caucuses are upon us tonight, and our Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell, is on the ground in Iowa to give us some perspective on whether the impeachment circus will overshadow the caucuses and who's surging in the polls just before the first round of votes. In my third block, the sexualization of American education continues apace as Democrats in the Washington State Legislature introduce a bill that would mandate comprehensive and LGBT-focused sex education for all children, including kindergartners. I've got Mark Malosha, Executive Director of the Family Policy Institute of Washington, to discuss the bill. And in my final segment, the National Association of Scholars has recently released an exhaustive study on the partisan registration and contributions of faculty in American higher education. Did the study reveal conformity of thought or individuality of ideology? Well, Mitchell Langbert, professor of business and management at Brooklyn College and co-author of this study, joins me to break it down. As a reminder, visit our podcast site, TonyPerkins.com, where you can find more information on today's guests and associated resources. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, this is quite a busy week in Washington, D.C. We start with the Iowa caucuses tonight, and we'll be discussing those in our next segment with Kenneth Blackwell. But this is a rather unprecedented schedule because of the delay on the impeachment vote to Wednesday, the best that Republicans could essentially do given the stonewalling by Democrats, as was anticipated. Now, in brighter news, President Trump will deliver his State of the Union address tomorrow, and our organization will be hosting an event Wednesday to highlight the growth of the underground church in Iran and the surge of religious freedom. Now, the Wild Week has another bright spot for faith with the National Prayer Breakfast on Thursday. So we're going to talk a little bit about these events with FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber. Travis, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the caucuses a little bit in our next segment. So I really want to start with where we are in terms of this impeachment vote. We know that we are going to eventually see a vote on Wednesday. It was the best in terms of the Republican leadership and what they could do to hurry up and cut to the end on this. And an acquittal is almost likely a certain outcome in this. Do we anticipate that there are going to be any surprises at this point between the remainder of tomorrow and Wednesday?
Yeah, Sarah, I don't anticipate any surprises, but you know, obviously we'll have to wait and see. I mean, certainly the timeline's gotten delayed a little bit here. We had the votes near the end of the end of last week, in which the Senate rejected a decision to voted down the decision to call more witnesses. So that set up a timeline in which we have oral arguments, closing arguments in the Court of Impeachment as the Senate is called during this session today, followed by the closing of oral arguments, legislative session, which senators are allowed to speak on impeachment. And then finally at 4 p.m. on Wednesday is the scheduled vote the Senate to vote on the two roll call votes on the two articles of impeachment. So that's basically the timeline we're looking at now. This obviously sends these events directly into a busy week with a number of events, including the State of the Union address tomorrow night. So obviously a lot going on.
Well, and again, the timing of the State of the Union address is extremely interesting because Trump is going to take the podium on Tuesday and the vote will come on Wednesday. So do we anticipate that he's going to make any reference to the fact that impeachment's vote is following the next day, or will he avoid it altogether?
We'll have to wait and see. I don't have any indication that he's going to reference this during the State of the Union. Certainly, it's a interesting timeline, aligning of the stars, so to speak, on these events. We expect, you know, just like in prior years, there are some members who will in various ways, in their own way, try to protest the State of the Union or make their own statement. But obviously, this is the opportunity that President Trump has to deliver an address. Obviously, as the name indicates, addressing the State of the Union, really laying forth the case for why his agenda and his policy priorities have benefited the nation, right? So if he does that, there's really not a lot that Democrats can do. Is the more he lays out the evidence that's on his side. And I think that's why you have really a small number of Democrats indicating they're going to set up their own sort of protest or statement or boycott the State of the Union. That's not a widespread sentiment in the Democratic Party.
Well, and this would be something that we could anticipate as the relaunching of his 2020 bid, really, because he's going to take the podium. He's not going to want to talk about impeachment. When Clinton did it in 1999, and that was less than a month from his State of the Union delivery to the actual vote for acquittal. So there was a proximity, not nearly as close, but he also did not mention impeachment. Trump's going to want to take the podium and he's going to want to assert the fact that he has a record of incredible accomplishments. He's a tinkerer. He may go in, he may toy with the speech, but by all accounts, he's going to want to make mention of what he's done internationally with trade, the strength of the economy. I don't anticipate seeing anything different.
No, and you know, he has a solid record to lay out before the American public. He's been so solid on the life issue as was just clear with his comments and record, but as cemented most recently with his comments at the March for Life. I expect he will mention that issue. I've seen an indication that he's going to reference school choice, lay out what his administration has done to open up educational opportunities, school choice, really, you know, which is a no-brainer when you look at the state of public education in so many ways in America, what it's really done or failed to do for students around America. President Trump's trying to open up new avenues in this area. Along with that, there's a religious freedom component to that, right, which, you know, he's mentioned he's going to address that idea, that topic, that part of his agenda. I think, you know, we're going to largely see him laying out why his agenda has been successful, you know, and he has a solid case to make that.
So in the middle of this very busy week is FRC's own event. Can you tell us a little bit about the event that we're hosting here at FRC that will be listener streamed online as well? So make sure to go to frc.org/events. You can register. We're also going to be sharing this on tonyperkins.com. But this is about an interesting rise of an underground movement for religious liberty and for evangelicalism in Iran, of all places.
Right. So our event focuses on Iran and religious freedom in Iran. Now, the reason we're doing this now is with Iran's prominence in the news, the situation in the Middle East. A lot of people are looking at Iran, saying, what do we think about Iran? How do we think about it? Things over there. There's a component to the Iran issue that involves religious freedom, involves the persecution of Christians specifically, that we think is important to highlight and bring out. Certainly part of the backlash against the Iranian regime is due to its repression of freedom, refusing to allow people to choose faith and live it out as they see fit. So we want to highlight that by including by featuring three speakers from Iran who've suffered persecution there. Two of them were imprisoned. The third one is families being prosecuted right now. So we're really excited to host them here at FRC, allow them to tell their stories and how their stories highlight the situation in Iran. We're going to feature that event Wednesday, noon to 1:30. People can register online, but even if they can't register, they can follow the event, watch it live streaming. That's on our website. It's called Stories from Iran, Religious Freedom and the Secret Growth of the Underground Church. The link is in the events section of our website, but you can also just Google FRC Iran event. It'll pop up there. So we're excited to have that. This obviously part of the schedule this week as we go into the National Prayer Breakfast events this week, specifically on Thursday. And this is going to bring a lot of people to town focusing on international religious freedom.
And on that precise note, the next day is the annual prayer breakfast. It's been around since 1953, very rarely attended by foreign dignitaries or soon to be foreign dignitaries. But this year, Taiwan's vice president-elect William Lai is going to appear. Now, he'll appear in his own capacity as opposed to his official capacity. But he really has angered China by saying that he is a realistic worker for Taiwanese independence. And this, to me, yet again, indicates that the world at large is taking a note of the fact that this administration is advancing the cause of freedom, of independence, of democracy, and of religious liberty, and understanding where we are in our negotiations, our ongoing tensions with China, particularly as concerns Hong Kong and what we've seen with those protests. I find it interesting that Taiwan's soon-to-be vice president himself is showing up, particularly under the same sort of theories, which are, I'm a fighter for independence. And obviously, they are paying attention that this administration supports that very same cause.
Right. And I think it makes sense that the Taiwan leaders are showing up at this. I was at an event in Taiwan last spring on international religious freedom. The Taiwanese president spoke at that event. This was in part organized by Bob Fu and his group at China Aid, focusing on religious freedom in China. A lot of the focus it was broader on Asia, but a lot of it was driven at China. It makes sense that these leaders are now coming to the United States at this time, the National Prayer Breakfast being a large gathering, the theme being international religious freedom. Additionally, we know that the United States is going to host at least 17 countries to launch the first ever International Religious Freedom Alliance this week during these events. Ooh. This was announced at the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom last summer, the second ministerial, this was announced, a gathering of nations worldwide that's going to band together formally to advocate for religious freedom around the world. Significant development under the Trump administration we've not seen previously, part of the administration's focus on these issues. We're very excited about this, along with other side events for the National Prayer Breakfast that the International Religious Freedom Roundtable Group is organizing.
Okay, so last event of the week is the seventh round of Democratic debates on Friday evening, obviously being held as a sort of supplement to the Iowa caucuses. I'm going to ask you to act as prognosticator, and we have a minute left. Who do you think emerges with a surge after Iowa's caucuses?
I mean, certainly we're seeing some trends indicating Bernie Sanders is hot right now. You know, and this is driven by you have anti-establishment feeling, but you also have a party drifting way to the left. And you look at the party's entrenched positions on social issues, abortion, the family, sexuality, growing more radical. You're not winning any people in the middle, and this cements the more radical fringe of the party.
It obviously does, and we understand that there are no moderates in today's Democratic Party. And in fact, there are nothing but progressives who are running right now to be Democratic presidential nominees. So that would not surprise me at all.
I think we're seeing the contrast ever more clearly in the life issue and other issues. And it, as Christians, we need to look at these issues biblically, continue to say, well, what is this person saying? How do we analyze it biblically? And then just let the facts lead us to our conclusion based on how we should think about these things.
Coming up next on Washington Watch, I have Ken Blackwell, FRC's Senior Fellow for Constitutional Governance, talking Iowa caucuses as he's on the ground there. He'll let us know who's surging right before the vote. Coming up next.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemicalabortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Tonight are the Iowa caucuses. Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is the first nominating contest for the Democratic presidential primary tonight. And just before Iowans are going to vote, we are seeing some surging from Sanders in the polls, surprising some people, but not us here at FRC as we watch the race to the left. But there in the Hawkeye State, we are going to speak with FRC's senior fellow for FRC Action, who is on the ground in Iowa. He's going to tell us a little bit about what he's seeing, what he's hearing, and what he anticipates there. Ken Blackwell, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's so good to be with you. And I tell you, it's an exciting time. It's a little cold, but it's not snowing. And there's high energy, both on the Democratic Party side, but surprisingly to a lot of folks on the Trump side, because everybody says, well, the president knows that he's going to be re-nominated by Iowans. Why is he putting such a show of force? And that's because Donald Trump is in the process of amassing the most impressive ground game in the history of American politics, and it starts by showcasing his ground troops right here in Iowa.
Well, it's encouraging to us to know that that is the direction that we're heading for him. I have to say, what I'm seeing is a lot of animation from the hard left, considering the fact that Bernie Sanders is now at 24% in the Real Clear Politics Index. And just a few weeks ago, he was at 16%. I have to guess, and I'm curious as to your thoughts, that what they see as the sham trial, what the Democrats see as a failure of their movement to unseat a sitting president on a trumped-up series of charges and an absence of evidence, but we won't go down that path, they seem to be emboldened to really show up for the most hard left of all these candidates. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that's what has some of the Democrat Party establishment worried. Bernie Sanders is an honest reflection of the hard left movement of the Democrat Party.
Yes.
They are comfortable in their new socialist environment and the philosophy and the legislative initiatives that grow out of that. You know that we are proud of the fact that we believe in our constitutional republic, that government needs a harness so that it stays small, because that optimizes individual liberty. This Democrat Party and the hard left, they are not moving just towards socialism. They're moving way past socialism to an autocratic state, which in fact will be a threat to religious liberty, will be a threat to local governance, will be a threat to individual freedom.
Well, and he's touted the fact that his ground game is strong, that he has an incredible grassroots presence, 22 field offices across Iowa, 200 field staff on the ground. He raised a whopping $50 million last year alone for his campaign. So do we anticipate any surprises with Biden or Warren, who are, in my estimation, the two closest contenders for this particular nomination? Buttigieg, it seems to me, is sort of waning. He's probably on the way out. Any insight either way on what you think Biden will do with his opportunity and his troops here in Iowa tonight?
Well, you know, I think he'll make a – he's sort of tapping down expectations in what we're hearing on the ground here. But the reality is that Bernie – might win tonight, but they will steal it from him again. They will change the rules, and as a consequence, they will, I think, underscore a real division within the Democrat Party. And the Trump campaign will sit back and watch that while they go neighbor to neighbor, church member to church member, you know, family member to family member, carrying the Trump message of making America great again. I was here in 1984 with Ronald Reagan, and he, in fact, was an incumbent president. He didn't have to come back. He came back with a message of mourning in America. This president is saying, we've put America back on the glad path of greatness, and we need that second term to make sure that we finish the job, get it done, and stymie the threat of big government socialism.
It doesn't seem to me that anyone else is nervous about the fact that Sanders has gone, as you said, truly beyond socialism. In fact, having the broad appeal that he does when he is so hard left and has even praised communist leaders in the past indicates to me that we are, as I've stated, sort of in a race to the left. He'll be pulling out the squad of four that we know in Congress who are the most hard left on issues and particularly anti-Semitic. So I'm finding tonight's outcome to be indicative of what the Democratic Party wants to envision for itself for the next 4 years, regardless of whether or not Sanders emerges triumphant. This is really an opportunity to shape the movement for the Democratic Party moving forward. And I think for them, moderates are completely disenfranchised.
Well, I think most Iowans will, in fact, rejoice over the fact that there have been 20,000 new jobs created under this president. There have been 60,000 or more Iowans that have come off food stamps. This president negotiated USMCA, and that means a whole lot to the farmers and agribusiness of the state of Iowa. And so they can move hard left. They can embrace big government, whether it's, you know, socialism or a more autocratic communist-like state. We, in fact, are betting on free markets and free people, and we believe that free people working in free markets will, in fact, advance freedom and maintain the prosperity of America. There's no accident why America, in 240-plus years, is the freest, the most democratic, the most prosperous human society in all of human history.
FRC Senior Fellow for FRC Action, Ken Blackwell, joined us. We'll be talking about education now. And just when you think it can't get more radical, more sexualized, it actually does. Now, if you are going to listen to what we have to say, let today be the day. We'll tell you what's happening in Washington State coming up right after this on Washington Watch.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a two-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home.
Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with five kids under the age of nine, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a six-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. We are also found on all podcast platforms. We're very excited about that. So find us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or me if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. And we're back to the topic of education, which, again, as a mother, I'm very passionate about. But if you live in Washington State, you have reason to be extremely concerned. What we're seeing is a bill proposed by Democrats, House Bill 2184, a measure that would mandate comprehensive sexual health education by the year 2022 for all students in public education, starting in kindergarten. And therein lies the rub. Comprehensive sex education, bad enough, even worse when it's your five-year-old child. I have with me today Mark Malosha, Executive Director of the Family Policy Institute of Washington, to help me break it down. Mark, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about how bad this bill actually is, because I never cease to be amazed at how bad public education can get. And I say this as a mother to three in the public education system, though we've not yet been subjected to this kind of horror. Tell me a little bit about this proposal from the Democrats.
Well, it's a horrible proposal. We saw this last year. We defeated it last session. But this year, with a new aggressive Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins, she started off as an LGBTQ activist before she became a legislator. Now she's the Speaker of the House. But they have a very aggressive agenda in for schools, completely transforming them, a complete top-down takeover from the local school boards, the local school districts. Now it's all going to be run and decided by the Office of Superintendent of Public Education. That's the statewide education chief here in Washington State. And this is Planned Parenthood's number one bill that they're pushing. In fact, they doorbelled my house in the fall. They're having a full court press trying to convince folks that this is good for children, while it does the complete opposite.
Well, let me tell you, my tax dollars, I don't want going to comprehensive sex education at all, let alone one that is mandated, constructed, put together by Planned Partnership, Planned Parenthood in partnership with radical Democrats, but I definitely don't want it for kids as young as 5 years old. What do we know about the composition of the state legislature, about the potential to pass a bill like this?
Unfortunately, the legislature changed in the last 2 years. Now it's got a real large radical left majority in both the House and Senate. And we have a governor whose wife was used to be on the board for a Planned Parenthood. So we know where the governor's office is on all these issues. But
Nice.
We're fighting an uphill battle, I have to be honest. But we're trying. We're trying to stop this bill. And in fact, there's another bill to put health centers, private health centers in all high schools, modeled on what you see going down in L.A. County where Planned Parenthood is running clinics and schools.
Right.
So that's the other 1-2 punch that we see going with the education system.
So you bring all of the healthcare, quote unquote, in-house, where you already have students as captive audience. You provide them with the aspirin that they request, while at the same time teaching them that you also have services for gender confirmation, such as hormones or birth control or condoms. So really, you do, as you said, have an uphill battle. So if I'm the average parent listening, tell me, Mark, what can parents do to fight this kind of a bill?
Well, two things. Immediately, call the legislative hotline, 1-800-562-6000. That's 1-800-562-6000. And just let your legislator know that you're opposing this. The second thing, join the movement. Go to fpiw.org. Get on our email list so you can follow and get involved in the long term. This is a long term fight. I must emphasize this. This is a long term fight. And be involved, and you'll be getting our notices about how to fight back against the sexualization of our children. This whole movement, which is designed to destroy parental rights, to turn children against parents and against churches and synagogues. That's what this whole movement is about, and ultimately the destruction of the child.
And isn't it interesting that it all comes back to eliminating the parent, separating the parent, divorcing the parent from actually knowing what's transpiring in the public education classroom? Because if you send the parents away, if you maintain their ignorance, then they certainly can't intervene on the behalf of their own child. So this is a rights, respect, responsibility, a K-12 proposal. That is the name that the Democrats have given it, and is often the case with bills this egregious. They have given them a benign name, an anodyne name that no one would think to question. But in this case, the 3 R's bill is proving to be incredibly problematic. And in fact, there are footnotes indicating that when these kindergartners are given male names and female names for body parts, all of that will change as they have a greater understanding of the gender spectrum. Mark Melosha, Executive Director of the Family Policy Institute of Washington, has been my guest. 1-800-562-6000 is the legislative hotline out in Washington State. FPIW.org is their website, and we'll have more information on ours at TonyPerkins.com. Well, coming up next on Washington Watch, more discussion on American education. And this time we go to academia, where a comprehensive study from the National Association of Scholars and one of the professors I'll have on next reveals precisely how left of center the American college and university system can be. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. the United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this busy Washington, D.C. week. It's Monday afternoon. Go to TonyPerkins.com. We've got plenty of information there, including information about a trip you won't want to miss. You just heard Tony at the break talk about a trip to Israel. If you've ever considered going there, and let me tell you, I have been three times myself, it is a trip that will change your walk. It will change you as a person, and it will give you a depth of understanding that will bless your life for generations to come. Join FRC for 9 days in the Holy Land with Tony Perkins, our General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, from June 2nd through the 12th. So not only then will the Bible come alive in transforming ways, but you get to hear from Israeli defense, political, and religious leaders about what's happening right now in the Middle East and in Israel. So go to TonyPerkins.com to find out more. Well, I think it's fairly certain in everyone's mind that the American Academy, higher education in America, trends left. In fact, data since after World War II has indicated as much. And William F. Buckley wrote his God and Man at Yale, highlighting left-wing excesses at prestigious universities more than half a century ago. And yet, we have a comprehensive new study out from the National Association of Scholars talking about how faculty, donations, registrations, activity shapes the perspective of liberalism in the American Academy. In fact, faculty gives to Democratic candidates by a ratio of 95 to 1. So joining me now to talk about this study is Mitchell Langbert, Associate Professor of Business Management at Brooklyn College and co-author of the study on the partisan registration and contributions of faculty. Welcome to the program, Mitchell.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be with you.
So I'm excited to talk about this because I love talking education, but I am disheartened by what it proved. Not that academia is left of center, but how very left of center it is. So let's start a little bit with the methodologies of the studies. What were some of the parameters of this particular study?
What I've been doing for the last few years is looking at specific institutions, specific colleges, and identifying a sample of professors. In some studies, I've done 100% of the full-time faculty. In this study, I took samples, and I have access to a database of political registration, which is available for 30 states plus D.C. Once I identified the political registrations of the professors, I then went back to the FEC, Federal Elections Commission, website and identified the federal contributions by the professors to candidates. And I determined which party they were giving to. Most of the time, most people give to one party or the other. But there were a few, maybe seven or eight, that gave to both parties out of 12,000.
Wow.
And yeah, so now what I've been looking at, I did a similar study with the leading research institutions in the social science departments about 3 years ago. And I did a study of industrial relations professors, and I did a study of the leading liberal arts colleges, the top 60 liberal arts colleges. So those studies were limited to institutions in the states that provide the voter registration data, whereas the point of this study was that I chose the top two private and top two public institutions for the 30 states that provide the data. And that's significantly different because the elite colleges are concentrated in just a few states. 14 states are almost exhaust the entire list of elite institutions. And these tend to be mostly Democratic states anyway. So there's that sort of added factor that the colleges are located in Democratic states, but they're inevitably far, far more Democratic than the state is. So what I've been finding for the social science departments, including law, psychology, at the elite places, it's 10 to 1 Democratic. At the liberal arts colleges, it's 10 to 1, but if you exclude West Point and the Naval Academy, it goes up to 12 to 1, so it's even more.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and in this study, I found 8.5 to 1, which in part because it included states like South Dakota, and Wyoming, which have much more conservative professors. Now, traditionally, it's been known that the more elite schools are more left, and that's why the entire system moves left, because in order to advance in academia, you have to publish papers in academic journals, and the editors of the journals are at the most elite colleges, which were the first to become predominantly left, and that goes back to the 20s, the 1920s, 100 years ago already. But it began, and then it was accentuated by the New Deal, and subsequently the post-Vietnam War generation kind of accelerated it further. So basically, the most elite schools have always had the most extreme bias, and also the other factor is that different fields differ. The bias is least in the hard sciences, math, and the professional subjects, and it's most extreme in the soft social sciences. Economics is much more moderate it's still heavily biased. I'm doing a new study on economics now, and what I'm finding is that although the rank-and-file economists are about 3 to 1 Democrat to Republican, at the very top levels of the economics field, the heads of the American Economic Association, for example, it's virtually 100% Democratic. There are almost no Republicans at the top of the field. So, in other words, the people who get access to jobs at the Council of Economic Advisors and who get the most publicity and are quoted in the New York Times and places like that are all winnowed. They've been screened for left-wing views. So basically, one of the complaints about the studies I've been doing is that, well, there's a large percentage that don't register. Many professors now are not even U.S. citizens anymore, and that's especially true in the sciences and economics. A big percentage are from foreign countries, and then people who do register are often non-affiliated. So we use the federal contributions as an additional check, and what I found was even more extreme, that it's not only that the Democratic professors give almost exclusively to the Democrats, it's also true that the unaffiliated professors give 50-1 to the Democrats. The non-registered professors give something like that to one, like 40 or something to one to the Democrats. And the Republican registered professors give 4-1 to the Democrats.
Oh, wow.
So the findings with registration are actually understated. There are people who sometimes, well, you know, the Mitt Romney syndrome, you know, there are people who are, you know, sort of Republican in name only, as they say. So how this came about, I think it's important to understand that academia is a little bit more democratic than most workplaces.
Right.
And the hiring is done collegially. So the professors themselves vote on whom to hire. So it's already being well established in the political science literature that people will tend to hire people who have their own political views. It's not just in academia, it's across the board, and there's been some solid research on this already. And on top of that, as I said, the fields tend to screen out nonconformists because the journal editors will not permit, they will tend not to permit. I'm not going to say there's never an acceptance for a conservative viewpoint paper, but it's much, much harder, much less likely to be accepted if you make claims that are consistent with more conservative or free market or Christian ideas. And so the two effects, the field effect from the top and the hiring effect from the side, contribute to an ongoing winnowing of anyone who doesn't conform. Now, how this came about is, as I say, the Democrats have tended to be much more favorable to higher education funding than the Republicans.
Sure.
You think about the GI Bill and the New Deal put a lot of money into colleges, and they funded in those days agricultural science programs to advocate New Deal agricultural policies and things like that. And so there was there's always been this kind of networking effect, such that the Democrats dominate the funding agencies like the National Science Foundation, which in turn tend to prefer studies that are consistent with the Democratic perspective. And so that kind of assistance will make the competition within the school virtually one-sided, and it was only a matter of time till Republicans virtually disappeared from the most elite places, and are only to be found if you go down the ladder to community colleges, where there's much less emphasis on research. In general, schools that don't emphasize research to the same degree as the elite places will tend to have more Republicans. So like a school like St. John's College in Maryland, which is a liberal arts college, they have a little bit more presence of Republicans than in the liberal arts colleges like Williams that put a lot of weight on research. And the same is true if you look at the other teaching colleges, they tend to have a much heavier presence of Republicans.
So, Mitchell, I'm going to ask you a big question in a short amount of time because we've got about 2.5 minutes left. But what do we do, understanding that there is ideological homogeneity at these schools, almost unassailable? It is so consistently across the board. What do we do, understanding now that they are outright hostile to dissenting perspectives, and we can rattle off a number of mob scenes everywhere from Berkeley to Middlebury College, where we know that to be the case? What do we do to insert more ideological diversity at the schools?
I think there are a lot of answers to that. First of all, we need to rethink whether college is the panacea it's been assumed to be.
Right.
And second of all, whether the funding should continue for schools that function as ideological advocacy organizations. The tax code, the section that provides tax exemption for colleges is 501c3, and it prohibits ideological advocacy or political lobbying for organizations that receive tax exemptions. Yet I would argue that much of what goes on in colleges is precisely that. So in other words, they're already breaking the law. They've been breaking the law for a very long time in that they claim on their tax exemption and their acceptance of tax-exempt donations from alumni that they're a tax-exempt organization and so not ideological. They do function as ideological advocacy organizations, and you gave a couple of examples with the kinds of courses that, you know, advocate certain perspectives on sexuality, gender,
right,
and so on. Not to mention economics. The institutionalist or liberal, quote unquote, perspective that government should play a very active role in the economy is just assumed in a lot of places, and there's very little room for alternative points of view. So freedom is mocked or viewed as not something that is important. The history classes increasingly function as ideological advocacy. The book by Howard Zinn is used in many colleges. It basically junk history.
It is. It's our favorite revisionist history textbook.
Yet it's used in high schools, in public high schools and colleges.
Mitchell, I got to let you go. I'm sorry. Okay. We're out of time. But, boy, thank you for your excellent work on this research. We're going to have a link to this publication, to this piece of literature, at TonyPerkins.com. Mitchell Langbert, Associate Professor of Business Management at Brooklyn College and co-author of this study. We've had you here on Washington Watch, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.